I give you Noble.
Well, thank you, Leslie, for being kind and gentle with me. Now, Leslie's got one of those personalities that when you meet her, you just gotta like her. I mean, you're either gonna hate her or you're gonna love her. And I was fortunate. I was one that just loved the heck out of you. You're just a good addition to this room and to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I see you doing a lot of work around here, working with others and chairing meetings and doing stuff. And that's what it takes to get sober. My name's Noble, and I am an alcoholic.
No.
Not much to tell you. And how long y'all want the meeting to last tonight, I can give you the short version if you'd like, and it goes something like this. I drank heavily for a long time and behaved very badly. Then I got sober. Things changed. So that's it. That's my kind of meeting right there, Daryl. I like that. I don't know. It's my story's not much different than anyone else, though. I look around these rooms and I've been. Well, wait a minute. Let me get everything qualified first. I was told when I first came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that whenever you tell your story, you make sure that you let people know that you're qualified to be standing in front up here at this podium and talking about recovery from the disease of alcohol, and the disease of alcoholism. My name is Noble, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March the 24th, 1991. I have two other things. I have a home group, a Toco group, right across the freeway over here, and I have a sponsor. How well I utilize that sponsor, only he can tell you, and I'm not going to share that secret, but I have a good sponsor and respect his opinion, his sobriety, and what he does, and he helps me a tremendous amount whenever I get off the beam. So with that, 20 years ago, I think about 22 years, 20, well, it's been 20 years ago, I came to Atlanta. And I had to leave the great state of Texas because all my exes live in Texas. And I had spent 2 months in jail for non-payment of child support and had an August appearance before the same judge again. And after I'd gotten out, and she had told me that if I didn't have a lawyer that time when I walked in to see her, that I was going to go back to jail. So, y'all got me. Here I am. I would have never imagined that I would have met the people that I met, and I'd be standing in front of a group of people talking. Now, whenever I was in high school, I pretty much had a normal upbringing. Mom and dad, middle-class people. Dad worked hard, was a union guy, worked himself all the way up through from the union as a helper all the way to being the head dog out on the chemical plant for the company that he represented out there, and went around the nation helping rewrite general specifications for a large industrial firm and everything. So I'm very proud of my father, but he drank, mom drank, we rodeoed and did things like that. So I got to ride horses. We lived out near on the edge of the country, and old lady Sykes had the farm, and I worked on the farm. So I helped with the pigs and the chickens, and I picked okra and, you know, planted things, and I'd done all that stuff and fed the cows. And so I had all that, and one of my favorite heroes when I was growing up was a guy named Pete Lovelace, which was a true bona fide little cowboy. And I loved that man. And coming home, leaving out of the driveway one night, foggy night there in my little hometown, after playing poker, Pete was drunker than 9,000 Indians, and he turned a little short and run off the culvert and hit the steering wheel with his side, broke a rib, and went through his heart. That was the end of my hero. But that was just normal growing up, you know. I think whenever I was about 8, 9 years old, Mom and Dad was over at a New Year's party, and it's my first drink that I had. I would go around and hold everybody's beer bottle while they were out there dancing, doing the jitterbug and all. And Mom and Dad liked to do that quite a bit. I sit out in a few bars, out in front of a few bars, Club 87 was one, for quite a few hours while they were in there doing that, entertaining myself. I don't know if any of the others had to had to do time in the back seat of the car and try to figure out what to do while they're in there drinking, but I managed to do that. Usually got in trouble. But that particular night, I'd gone around, I held everybody's beer for them while they were out dancing. Most time when they come back, they'd be empty. And I don't know how many of these I'd done. I don't think very many. But they found me out at the front of the garage, which is a big two-car garage, and they were having the dance inside, and I was right out at the thing. And I got sick all over somebody's car. And it just tore me up, got me sick. And so, you know, they took me home and everything. And that's about all I remember is I got sick, real sick. And so that made an impression on me. I had no desire to drink alcohol. But then I started growing up and I become a teenager. And, you know, in my junior and senior year, my junior year particularly, a lot of things were changing. Now, I'd been defiant and I'd been exhibiting a lot of alcoholic behavior. I started smoking. I started wanting to run around with the punks around town, you know, and a lot of them were just little thugs and all in hindsight. But boy, they were people I liked right then, and we smoked, and I stole mom's cigarettes, and I'd get caught, and I'd get punished, and I got defiant, and that was it, you know, and so that was the way it started from about the eighth grade on. But in my junior year in high school and all, I started wanting to date girls. You know, y'all had another purpose besides being mean to them by that time. And all of that. And mom wouldn't let me because of my behavior that I exhibited before and always being mean and mischievous. She didn't trust me. So she kept a tight rein on me. So where other people could go out and do things and run around with their friends, I wasn't allowed to go out and do other things, go to the skating rink, so to say, or, you know, go do things like that, the bowling alley. Oh, only once or twice I got to do that, and I had to be home. They come got me an hour after they dropped me off, so, you know, to make sure I didn't have time to get in trouble. And that was me growing up. I had no desire to drink back then, but I turned 18 the second month of my senior year. And Buddy and I went out drinking, went across the river into Louisiana. In Louisiana, you could be 18 then. So we went over there, stayed out till 3 o'clock in the morning. My dad was looking for me and the whole bit, and I drank again, and I liked it. And I had been introduced to marijuana by that time. And this is back in the hippie days, and so I was running around with a crowd that had the little longer hair, you know, and we liked to roll the funny cigarettes, and we liked to drink and everything. And I got curfewed over that, and Mom and Dad grounded me for a month or something like that, and so I just moved out of the house. I was 18, don't have to put up with your stuff no more. And so I did that, and what happened at that point was that I got a taste of my own freedom, and I went absolute hog wild. I mean, I was able to do whatever I wanted to, could write my own notes, go to school. We'd skip school. We'd all meet at school in the mornings. This was just typical of a day for me, and we'd meet there about 7:30, and we had an infomaniac in the class, so whoever got there first, anyway, and I won't go into that story, but we'd all gather, and we'd get up in one car, and we'd all make a run over across the river, and we'd buy about 8 or 9 bottles of Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill. We'd see how many joints we could smoke, how many bottles of wine we could drink. Coming back, and by our second period class, we'd get back to school and walk in, and I was pushing off the ceiling. I mean, all I had to do was a half year. It's all I needed to get the credits I needed to graduate. So did it, and we made it, and I got out of class. And I'll tell you this, because it kind of sets a precedent for everything in my thinking from then on till I got into this program. There were 223 people in the class that in my school, and I graduated number 112. Any of you that did better than me in school has already got it figured out. And if you didn't, I'll tell you, if you were in from 113 on to 123, I was dead middle. I was either the best of the worst or the worst of the best. You know, so that's the way my attitude was from then on. I didn't have the confidence in myself, and I kind of lacked some of that. got out of school, given good opportunities to work, and I did all of that stuff, but I was defiant. My dad had given me a golden opportunity to earn the money to go to college. I didn't want to go to college. I wanted to smoke dope, drink, and chase girls. That was it. And so he called me into the office one time because it was getting to where it was not good for him on the business scene. And he said, look, you're going to have to cut your hair and straighten up or go find another job. And without batting an eye, I said, Papa, you know, I love you, but I got to go get another job. And I left. Good opportunity. Went to Houston, and it was off to the races. I didn't have anyone looking over my shoulder. I could do whatever I wanted to do. I'd go about 4 years, and something had happened. You know, I got arrested quite a few times. Let's just say that. And about every 3 to 4 years, my feet would get kicked out from under me from drinking and drugging, and something would happen, and I'd have to start all over. I'd lose that job, and have to go pay all my fines off and everything, and get off of probation, and then go, and, you know, a couple of years later, there I was again. And that seemed to be a reoccurring theme with me. Same with relationships, you know. Just could not have a steady relationship. I could go a while, and everything was good, and then I guess in hindsight, I was one of those that liked to sabotage myself, you know, if it was getting too good, I'd just do something to mess it up, or I'd get my ego, if I was really honest with myself, would be get a little too big. So, well, you know, this is going good. She likes me and everything. Hell, there's a bunch of girls out there probably like me. No, I'll just go, you know, I can go do that. And never worked out. Just never worked right for me. Ended up still defiant, doing the things that I wanted to. Couldn't excel very well in work, and you know, always wanted to tell the bosses how they needed to run their business type thing, and a lot of bad experiences with that. Drank every day, and from the time I began drinking, I drank every day. What would happen was that I'd just go find another job. But I ended up moving out of one town, moving to another. So there was a geographical cure, and had a friend of mine that moved up to this little big old town in East Texas. It had 168 people in it, and two single women. Went up there for a fish fry one Friday night, and ended up marrying one of the single women, staying there for a couple of years. But it didn't work. I was still drinking. I didn't want to commit to a family. She got pregnant trying to make it work and had a son, which at the time he was 3, I took another geographical cure and I moved to Austin, Texas. And there my drinking really went crazy. And he was a part of my life. I'd pay my child support. I'd go get him every other weekend and try to do that. But I wasn't doing very well. I was still drinking, partying, and chasing women was still the big thing. And that's what I wanted to do. And here I was now. I was up. I was 35 years old, and things weren't working. Had a little business, and drinking and drugging and chasing women were more important than tending to that. And had golden opportunity. And I blew it. That's whenever I got to the point where in my drinking that it turned on me. Things started changing. I've always been a people person. I love to be around people. I drank in bars and I'd shut them down. That's why I love to do it. And we'd go find, you know, somebody else's house and we'd keep on partying. Love that stuff and everything. But got to where I started isolating. And I started getting down. I started getting depressed. And things were catching up with me. And I wasn't happy. My drinking wasn't doing it for me. I couldn't get high enough. I couldn't get drunk enough. And, you know, whenever I got too drunk, I wasn't happy with being too drunk. Because I was stumbling around. And a lot of times, I mean, I was a cheap date. You know, I could go out you could give me a couple of beers. And I'd just be drunker than a wall-eyed piss ant, you know. I couldn't do anything. And so it was just the alcohol wasn't working. I wasn't happy on the inside, and yet my ego was going, and it was just crazy. So I come up, and I said, you know, this ain't working. My business was failing, and my big client had kind of put me on probation and said, if you can get your bills paid up and get things caught up, then, you know, we'll give you some more work. But without his work, I couldn't earn the money. My alcoholic mind just went off, and he become a son of a bitch, and I was, you know, I was okay. I was just trying to do the right thing by everybody. I found myself increasingly riding the back roads around Austin, just drinking and just being by myself, and moved from the house I'd been in for a long time, got a little old rent house, and just closed the drapes and stayed in there. And finally, I drove around, and I formulated a plan. I said, you know, a geographical cure. I didn't call it a geographical cure. I said, you know, I know what to do. I'll just, you know, I'll show these people. They'll be sorry. And so I just run a little ad in the paper. Said, house sale. You know, garage sale, whatever you say, you know. And I just opened up the front door of the house one Friday, and they came in, and I sold all my little treasures and all my everything I had. And in 2 days, it was gone. I made a big whopping $800. And here I was rich, man. I was real rich. But sold all my treasures, and I had met a man at a little country bar out there, and He had a horse, a big dun horse that I wanted to buy. And I went and bought that horse, and I got a little Shetland pony because my plan was that I was going to ride off into the sunset on horseback. So I got in that horse. I couldn't find a little mule for a pack mule. You know, you got to carry all your stuff because, I mean, that was the 80s. You know, you couldn't just, it wasn't a bedroll and a coffee pot. You had to carry your stuff. So, I had all the tack and everything, but I couldn't find a mule, so I bought a Shetland pony. Any of you know about Shetland ponies? They're mean little horses, real mean. And I called up my buddies. I got a trailer one day and loaded them all up and everything. Called up my three buddies that we were all unemployed at the time and just didn't do anything but sit around, drink, and play cribbage. So I called them up and said, look, I need you to carry me out to West Texas. So, hell, it was a good idea to them. Good chance to drink. So we loaded up in the truck and we drove out to, out to West Texas, about where the desert starts changing, the plains start kind of getting a little drier, a lot more mesquite, a lot more cactus and all of that. And it was getting close to dark about then, and we were drunker 9,000 Indians anyway, and everything. Got there and drank the rest of the night around a little fire. Had me and my friends. I had my two horses. Well, one of them had got away. Guy had let him out of the trailer. No sooner than we parked, he went and opened up the trailer, and Shetland was gone. Had my little dog, Boo Boo, with me, big black lab. So there we were. And the next morning, he come up, and we all woke up and had a hangover and drank, you know, popped off on a beer. We drank beer, and they said goodbye, and I said so long, and told Steve, just, you know, drop my truck off at GMAC when you get back into town. Just give it to them. And that's what he did. Yeah. So there it was. I was out in West Texas on my horses and finally caught the Shetland, though. It took me 2 days chasing that little bastard around, and I got him. But finally got him. Everything got everything loaded up, man. My big dream, I'm coming around. It's fixing to happen. And my idea was ride the railroad tracks, because on railroad tracks you can go across anything. There's not very little that you can't cross, and you don't have to worry about speeding cars and all that, and the dog getting run over and everything. I figured I'd, you know, deal with an occasional train or so. Anyway, there was a railroad track right up there, Ballinger, Texas. Just 50 feet away, just getting there. Me and the horse got the little Shetland in the back, and he's leading along. We're just doing good. Dog's over here walking. All of a sudden, a Shetland just come up behind the big horse and just stuck his nose right up his rear, right up under his tail. Big horse didn't like the little horse doing that. He reared up, and he started. Well, when he reared up and kicked, well, the little horse, he started pulling backwards, and the little Shetland was pulling backwards. Big horse was rearing up, trying to go forward, and I was stretched out here in between the middle of them, and I was trying to hold on to everything. The dog was barking, and I hit the ditch. I come off, hit the ditch. Big horse went that way, little horse went that way, and all my shit right down the highway. You know? And the dog comes over and licks me in the face. You know? Had one faithful companion out of the bunch, anyway. So I rounded them back up and sold them to a man there. I'd had a relationship with a woman that for about 2 years there in Austin, and I was really trying to run from her too. You know, didn't tell her I was leaving, nothing. And she had invested quite a bit of time and heartache with me through everything that I'd been through, and I had put her through some things that today, to this day, I still shake my head and am ashamed of some of the things that I put her through. And so I had to call her, and she got in her car, and she drove out there and picked me up and brought me back. And now we're back to where I started this story out at. I went to jail for 2 months for non-payment of child support and everything, and she came and got me and took me out, and then I went to court, and the judge said, you know, if you don't come back with a lawyer, you're going to jail. And I had my old truck and was staying with her, and I told her, I said, I got to leave. Got to go. And so I loaded up my truck and loaded up my dog. And in August, I took off and started driving to big cities, all the big cities. Went up to Little Rock, went up to Memphis, and went up to St. Louis. And had quite a few drinking experiences in St. Louis. That was an interesting little town. Come around to Nashville, and that was pretty nice. But I had a friend here in Atlanta, over in Marietta, and I called him, and there was a lot of work. He gave me a place to stay, and got here, and within 2 days, I had two or three job offers. I was working, and things were on the way up again. And this is my buddy, my best friend, still is my best friend. And we always drank like fish whenever we were together. Well, he still drank. I still drank. We had a lot of good times together here in Marietta. But my drinking had changed, and it just wasn't doing real well. And I ended up going to work, got a good job with a good company, had a car and the whole thing. And a girl that was in Austin moved out here. And a whole bit, I got a DUI, and I lost that car, and I lost that job. And she was working. She had a little Ford Escort, and then we got another little car. And I had a Volkswagen that I bought for $200 and had to rebuild the motor on, and that's where I was at. I was starting out all over again. There was that 2 to 3 year or 3 to 4 year thing, my feet getting kicked out from under me. And then I got another DUI, and that was in Tennessee. And then I got another one in Smyrna. And so, boy, they were just piling up. And I had a probation officer named Margarita, yeah, over in Cobb County. And I had two probations that I was doing, and I was being defiant. I didn't want to do the little driving test, the insurance, whatever the heck it was she wanted me to do. I didn't want to do it. Cost too much, didn't have time. And I was still being defiant. And I was still mad at my lawyer for, you know, not trying to go in there and win my case because I wasn't drunk the second time. And da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I was still, you know, just all alcoholic. But in the meantime, girl that was living out here had come out from Austin. She left. I had gotten fired from just about every job. And I worked construction. Now, whenever you start getting where you can't get a job in construction, you know, something, you may want to pay attention, and things weren't looking too good. And, oh my goodness, I'm about to get sober here, and it's not even halfway over yet. She left. I was barely employed. I had about $10 to my name. And the best thing that the probation officer did is instead of throwing me in jail or making me do anything, she said, okay, if you'll just go do some AA meetings, we'll forego the little meeting, the little school thing, whatever it was I didn't want to do. And I said, okay, that's a good deal. And that evening I picked up the phone. I called the AA central office phone number out of the book. Guy answered and told me they were just right down the road. And they weren't. They literally were about 6 blocks down the road from where I was at when he answered the phone. And that was the Atlanta Biscayne Room. He invited me up there. And so I got in the truck. And that weekend was when she had left. And this was on a Wednesday. And I was down. I was probably at one of the worst emotional bottoms I'd ever been in. I was depressed. And I always liked people. Not knowing what to expect whenever I got to an AA meeting, I kind of figured there'd be people standing around a burning barrel, you know, long trench coats on, drinking wine or something. I don't know. I did not know what to expect, but I got down to the Biscayne room and I walked in the door, and there was laughter, and there were people shaking my hand, wanting to introduce themselves. And it was just my kind of place, man. I liked it. I liked what I heard. Still had that deer in the headlight look, you know, big eyes and wondering what the heck's going on. And had a little old woman up there named Chris Griffin, a little old gremlin-looking woman. We love you, and we need you, and we want you to come back. That's what she would always tell everyone. She told me that the first time I was there. Well, we sit down, and on Wednesday nights at the Biscayne Room at that time, it was a four-step study. And they broke out these little books, and they read, and not a four-step study, it was a step study, and they were on the four-step. Just my luck, you know. Now, I didn't know anything, but they started going around, they read the thing, and while they're reading, I'm listening, I heard this, and I said, shit, that's exactly what's going on with me. And I mean, absolutely. I'm not exaggerating that. I know I'm from Texas, and you know, I embellish a little bit, color the truth sometimes maybe, but that was the absolute truth. I heard me in what they were reading. And then they started sharing, and they're starting laughing about those things that were tragic to most people and things I had resentments over. They just were falling out of their chairs, and I'm going, what's wrong with these people? But I could relate. I mean, I could relate to their sick sense of humor. So by the time the meeting was over, they asked if I wanted to say anything, and I, you know, still, I didn't know what to do, but I stood up and I said, thank you. I said, y'all, I heard something here, and I didn't know what it was, because I liked it. And I sat back down, and, you know, the meeting was over, and I went home, and I finished off my six-pack, and I passed out and went to bed. And I did this for about 2 weeks. I wasn't ready to surrender, you know. I didn't have any ulterior motive. I didn't have anything in my mind about who these people were or what kind of gimmick. Were they trying to sell me something? What was the deal? It wasn't any of that. It's just I wasn't ready to give up. I was still defiant. And finally, after about 2 weeks, on March 24th, it was actually on Saturday, I said, I'm going to do it. You know, I'm just going to do it. This is my last day. So I decided that I'm the type, when I make big changes, I just go ahead and quit everything. You know, it's going to be a whole new deal. So I had been, I told y'all when we started the story too that you steal mom's cigarettes. Well, dad smoked Winston, she smoked more Salem's. So I did that until I could afford my own. Then I started smoking Marlboro, smoked those all my life until I got up to whenever I was married, and they got kind of weak. So I started smoking Swiss or Sweet Cigarillo, non-tips, and inhaling them because they were stronger and they worked good. So I'd done that all the way up to the time I walked into the room. I decided that I would just quit smoking and quit drinking all the same time. And that was Saturday, so I smoked like a little choo-choo train and drank like a fish. And I drank everything I had and smoked everything I had, and I passed out. And I woke up the next morning, I went to the Biscayne, I picked up a white chip. And I had been there enough to know that that there was a power greater than myself. And so I just immediately started relying on a power that's greater than myself. I made it down there to the meetings all the time. I was going to do the 90 and 90. But what I really loved was the people down there didn't criticize. They didn't put me down. They didn't want to know anything about me but that I drank too much. They treated me like a person, treated me with respect, and I felt comfortable in those rooms. And when I'd leave there and I'd go home, there would be the loneliness. There would be the stuff that I didn't like. So I enjoyed the meeting. And thanks to God, my understanding, the compulsion to drink was removed fairly quickly. That and the advice of an old-timer had been there and was going to the Monday night men's meeting. And he pulled me aside one evening, and I was full of anger whenever I got in there. I don't know why, but, you know, judges and IRS and government entities and things like that just pissed me off. And I could go, you know, I had these resentments. And I didn't even know what a resentment was whenever I came in to the program. But he pulled me aside and he said, Noble, says, look, now all you got to remember out of this deal is that when you walk out of that door, there's alcohol everywhere you go. I mean, everywhere. At the service station, the supermarket, whatever you do. At the restaurant, you sit down to eat, there's always going to be alcohol out there. So you can have alcohol anytime you want. What may do you well to remember is that you just can't drink successfully. And that was the magic word. The light bulb went off, and whenever I, you know, thought about it, he was absolutely right. I had not drank successfully all my life. You know, I'd gone out there, I'd get drunk, I'd wallow around, I'd get in trouble, couldn't stand up straight, slur my words, you know, get slapped in the face quite a bit, and things just didn't work. My life didn't work. But I didn't know all of that until I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and someone started sharing their experience of what they went through and what happened to them and what it was like now, just like I'm doing. And they shared their experience with me and what happened and what they were doing right then to stay sober that day. And, you know, it seemed pretty simple. Don't drink and go to meetings. God, you hear that so much, you want to get sick of it. But it's that simple, you know, just that simple. You can hate it all you want, but if you don't drink and go to meetings, you don't get drunk. If you don't get drunk, you got a chance to get over the hatred, you know, hearing that. And so, anyway, I stuck around. I've not had to have a drink since I came in. I'll tell you this, though. When I got in there and found out that it was just a symptom, my alcohol or drinking alcohol was just a symptom of my disease, that really I suffered from assholism is whenever it really got to be kind of discouraging, kind of sad. You know, you realize that you think that just quit drinking is going to do it. Well, it didn't do it. So I was one of those half measures and type guy, and I didn't want to do everything exactly right. I wanted to hang on to my ego, and I wanted to try the easier, softer way and all of that. And so I went a good while before I ever got a sponsor. I think it was about 2 years, something like that. And didn't work on a four-step for a good while, but it was becoming apparent that I needed to. And pain is what drove me. For almost everything that ever growth spurt that I've had in this program, it's been involved with pain and fear. I was very, very angry when I came in. So I remember what forced me to do a four-step was that I was working on a third-story building and a three-story building. Well, I was working on the third floor of a high-rise building, let me say it that way. And my helper, we were walking up before we'd ever rolled out to get ready to go to work, and he had already pissed me off. And I was so mad, I was shaking, and I wanted to throw this man off the building. I mean, I literally was ready to just kill him. And I was so shook up, I turned around, said, I'm going home, can't do it. And I went home, there had been a bar between me and the house. At that point, I would have stopped and drank. And that was at about 2 years in the program. And I didn't even have a desire to drink. But I was so angry, I hadn't worked the steps, wasn't doing what I was supposed to do. I was hanging out in 1, 2, and 3. Had those down pat. But, you know, it wouldn't do me any good because I wasn't getting any better. I was still exhibiting all the things that really caused the pain and misery whenever I was out there drinking. And I got to the house and, you know, the committee's going in my head and I'm pacing back and forth all around the house. I had a little video house, so I was making the whole trail. And it just so happened that on the dining table in there, in the kitchen, there was a notepad sitting there. And I must have walked by it 100 times that day. And I was throwing this man out the window. I mean, in my mind, the insanity was absolutely rampant. And all of a sudden, I looked down at that notepad and the voice in the back of my head said, "Why don't you sit down and do a four-step?" And I did. That's what it took. And there I was just that far from wanting to drink. And I sat down and started writing. And I don't know if I wrote a four-step properly. I struggled with that with the big book. But I sit down and I wrote about me. And I wrote about my character defects. And I wrote about what was wrong with Noah. And so that was how I got that accomplished. And I went on and I started doing some of the other steps. And I thought they were going to be real easy to do. And you know, 6 and 7 looks pretty simple. There's no problem, you know, sure. Okay, I'm ready. Yeah. I'm ready. God, won't you take this shit? I don't need it no more. I'm okay, done, you know, let's move on. Then I got to eight, and I said, make a list of the people we had harmed and become willing to make amends to them. That's all it says. Me, here's my math. I'm dyslexic, I found out. Because, see, I turned it around. It says, become willing to make a list of the people we had harmed and make amends to them. Yeah? So, I could not find that willingness to sit down and make a list. You know, how do you start listing everybody you had harmed, and how do you know who you harmed and who you didn't harm? And how do you know? And boy, there I was. I was too damn smart again. And I was just going crazy. And the mental gymnastics and all that was going on, it was insane. Now, you know, look at me on the outside. Y'all might not have known it, but I was crazy. You know, and I knew I was. And it just, I'd gotten a sponsor by this time, obviously, and he used to always, I'd go to him, he'd say, you know, this is the inside job. It's an inside job. It's about the total deflation of ego, and he'd just keep doing that, you know. It's an inside job, Noble. You got to keep working on it. It's an inside job. And never pressure me, never push me. I don't know if that was good for me or bad. I guess the good thing is that I haven't found it necessary to take another drink. Somehow I've muddled through this thing. At about 10 years of sobriety, I had gotten I'd gotten this wonderful job. Now, it was my last chance. I wanted to be in supervision, didn't want to work my tools anymore, and got a wonderful job. I was going to Al-Anon by then. I had met this wonderful woman. Actually, I'd met her when I was about 2 months sober. And she was very sober herself, and she wouldn't give me the time of day after she found out I'd only been in there two months. She had like 11 years at that point. And so she wouldn't even talk to me for about 6 or 7 years. And finally I got her to give me a date. And then she told me at one point right after that, don't you ever call me again. And so, don't ever call me. Now, being a good keen alcoholic, that was the challenge there, you know. You had to do something about that. So I got to thinking, and I got to thinking, and it was, there was, I forget if it was Christmas or it was somewhere in December, but anyway. So what I did is I waited until I knew she was at a meeting, and I went and I bought a box of candy. I bought some flowers, and she liked gargoyles, and so I bought her a little gargoyle thing. And when she come home from the meeting to open up her front door, there was flowers, candy, and a gargoyle, and a little card, you know. I said, I know you told me not to call, but would you please read this? Well, it worked. And I put her through a few twists and turns, but she married me in 1999, and I'm lucky to have someone with 11 years sobriety, but she drove me to Al-Anon. So here I was now. One of the things my Al-Anon sponsor told me at 10 years whenever I was got this job, he said, look, just take God to work with you every morning. Remember, He's in charge. And it went along good for about 9 months, and then it got fast and furious, and I got out there, and by God, I was making it happen, and I was doing it, and I was in charge again, and the whole thing. And the people that were working out there with me ran, and they turned against me. It was just like it says in the play, in the book, in the big book about the director trying to direct everything. And everybody turned and just turned on me. And I lost that job. And it put me in a depression. About a month-long depression, and I laid on the couch, and Sid would get up to go to work in the morning, and I'd get up and act like I was looking for work, you know, going through the phone book, and I'd make a few cursory calls so she wouldn't figure out what was going on. And as soon as she walked out the door to leave to go to work, I hit the couch, and I couldn't get off of it. And I did that for a whole month, and I'm getting to feel worthless and sorry, and the more I lay there, the worse I felt about myself. And I mean, I was my own worst enemy. I was kicking it. And the only thing that pulled me out of it was finally, I said, you know, I'm supposed to call on the God of my understanding and ask for help. And that's what I did. I got off that couch, I rolled off of it, got to the coffee table, got on my knees and said, God, I can't do this no more. I need your help. And it changed. I went to work within a week and started working and have been working successfully ever since. Now, I don't work well with others. You can ask Mike over there. He works with me now. And so I had to work for myself and by myself. And I did okay with that. And what I learned out of that was that once I call on the God of my understanding and ask for help, somehow it happens. It's been proved to me 1,000 times in these rooms and in my sober life. And whenever it's something I don't know what to do with and I ask God for help, the answer comes. And that, to me, is the little miracles of this program. I have to say that I have shortcomings. I have character defects. Some of them are way, way, way back in the corner of that closet back there in my mind. They're way back there, and they got a lot of other stuff over them. And a lot of them I'm very conscious of, and I ask God to keep taking care of them, and I don't want them. But I can still get angry in a heartbeat. I can still get off the beam in a nanosecond if I don't keep the God of my understanding in my life on a daily basis. And I don't always do that. That's the beauty of it. No, I'm sorry, that's not the beauty. That's a tragedy of the disease of alcoholism. You know, it just, I have to get up every day and remember I'm an alcoholic. It's not so much that I can't drink alcohol today. I need to remember that if I do drink alcohol today, things just got real, real bad. But I have to remember that I'm an alcoholic. I don't think like most people think. Don't think like normal people do. And that I can have all my misery back in just a heartbeat if I don't pay attention to what the principles behind all of these steps say. If I don't try to practice these principles in all my affairs, I'll be off the beam and I'll have a bad day. And basically, that's where I'm at right now in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just trying to maintain, trying to wait for the next step. There's always another growth step. There'll be a little bit of pain come along, and I'll have to go through it. My fears aren't quite as bad today as they were 17 years ago. They're not as bad as they were 10 years ago. But just recently, I've taken another step with business, and man, I'm scared to death. You know, and it's just little bitty things. So I'm going through it all again. And it just has to always come right back to it. God has always given me what I needed. Doesn't give me what I want, but He's always given me what I needed. And it's gotten me to this point right now today. And so for that, I'm grateful. And for y'all, I'm grateful. Thank you.